From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. President Trump has released his plan for replacing the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan. It would hand much of the authority and responsibility for regulating greenhouse gas emissions back to states. Now, the Clean Power Plan faced a barrage of legal challenges and never actually went into effect. The new rule is also likely to be challenged in court, and some analysts have said it will be easier to defend than an outright repeal would have been. For some context on this whole situation, we turn now to Sabrina McCormick. She's an associate professor of environmental and occupational health at George Washington University's Milken Institute School of Public Health, and she's the lead author of a new analysis of more than 25 years of climate litigation. Sabrina, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You have looked at lawsuits going back to 1990, a total of 873 different lawsuits. Take us back to the beginning. What were some of those early lawsuits about?
The earliest lawsuits, as you might expect, have to do with air. The Clean Air Act was enacted in 1970, and this is the primary regulation through which litigants have attempted to address climate change through the courts. And so, in fact, in our analysis, the vast majority of cases use the Clean Air Act and attempt to address air quality issues by limiting airborne pollutants and greenhouse gases.
It's been almost three decades of litigation. You know, you said the Clean Air Act is the basis for it, but have some of the goals or the tactics shifted in that time?
Absolutely. And in fact, that's a very important point when we look at success rates of different kinds of litigants. So we coded all of our litigants by anti-regulatory and pro-regulatory. And when we look at success rates of those attempting to address climate change or advance it through the courts, more recent strategies that actually are not as focused on air are more successful. So the highest level of success rates we see is when litigants attempt to bring cases about renewable energy and energy efficiency. And these cases are quite successful. And I should say, in relation to this current new Clean Power Plan revision that Trump has just put through, that in fact, part of what's enabled those cases to be successful is the legitimacy of states to advance their own renewable energy plans and standards. That's one kind of strategy that has been more recent. That didn't start until about 2013. We see more of those cases in the courts. And then we also see cases around that attempt to protect endangered species and biodiversity issues. And some of those cases have been used to address climate change, and they have been quite successful as well.
Going back to what you were saying about strategies not relating to air quality, but to renewable energy and to states' rights to pursue renewable energy, what do you think that might bode in terms of legal challenges to the Trump administration's Affordable Clean Energy Rule and how those might fare?
Well, you know, really it's two different things in the sense that what Trump is allowing to happen with this new revision is the continued operation of coal-fired power plants that, as they have admitted, as the administration has admitted publicly, will cause increased mortality and morbidity of a number of different kinds of disease. And fights against those kinds of plants are one thing. And they're a very important thing, and I do expect that there will be some real success around countering this new move, if for no other reason, because we have real evidence on the administrative record that harmful effects to human health and well-being of these plants can make a difference to courts, that judges actually care about whether or not human health is being adversely affected by these kinds of energy developments and energy sources. But to the point of the renewable energy and energy efficiency, and I think this is maybe the most important finding of our study recently, is that, you know, you can keep fighting coal-fired power plants, and you should, and that should continue to be a part of litigation in the climate realm. But one area that there's a lot more work to be done in is simply advancing the proliferation of renewable energy facilities across this nation. And in our analysis, we see that that can be done through the courts.
Well, and in fact, you know, you said you coded everything pro-regulatory or anti-regulatory. You also kind of grouped cases into different goals that they might have had, one of which would be to force the government or regulators to take steps to reduce greenhouse gases. But there are some others in there. What were some of the other goals that you saw in climate litigation?
Well, fundamentally, plaintiffs often attempt to stop the licensing or the expansion of coal-fired power plants. Now, obviously, this affects greenhouse gases as well as other airborne pollutants that affect human health. Plaintiffs also attempt to reduce the methane emissions from waste sites or from hydrofracking that also have effects on human health and well-being and pollute localized groundwater. Now, on the alternative side, we have anti-regulatory plaintiffs that are attempting to reduce regulation, and this is happening especially in some conservative-leaning states across the country. Then back to the pro-regulatory side, those kinds of litigants are often trying to stop challenges to renewable fuel standards and to advance renewable energy mandates at the state level. And these can involve disputes over investments in new energy development or the retrofitting of fossil fuel-based kinds of energy development. So fundamentally, we're seeing a lot of kind of work centering around our energy portfolio in this country. And then we also see litigants taking issue with protection of biodiversity and endangered species that might be affected by climate change. And I'll just talk about one case explicitly here that got a lot of attention around 2009, and that is the polar bear case, where actually anti-regulatory plaintiffs took issue with the polar bear being listed as an endangered species. And part of the kind of the issue that they had with that listing was that if you protect the polar bear, you have to protect its habitat. And in that habitat are massive fossil fuel resources that pro-regulatory plaintiffs would like to keep in the ground. So this is oil that would result in greater greenhouse gases. So even when you're focusing on wildlife and biodiversity and animals and polar bears, you can affect the trajectory of climate change.
I want to talk about one case that's been going on for, I think, about 4 years at this point. And it's a group of young people that have been suing the government or attempting to sue the government over their failure to act, saying that that violates their right, future generations' right, essentially, to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the Supreme Court just earlier this month ruled that that case could actually go forward in district court. I think that'll be in October. That seems to be different than a lot of what you're talking about, which is, you know, pretty nitty gritty, like stop this power plant, put this regulation into place. This is a much broader kind of case, isn't it?
Yes. In fact, what you have your finger on there is we're talking about two different kinds of cases. Most of the cases that are in our database and most of the cases that, I mean, the vast majority of cases that have taken place so far are statutory cases. So these are cases that depend on existing law and upholding existing law. But what you're talking about with that case, which is the Giuliana case, is called common law. And within that realm of law, you have cases like Giuliana, which is invoking the public trust. So the need to leave our planet to the next generation in a condition that's livable. Within that realm of climate change suits is also nuisance suits. And we see these proliferating across the country right now as well.
Can you clarify what you mean by a nuisance suit?
The kind of most typical case that I most recently that we might think of in a climate change lawsuit is this fossil fuel cases. So these cities that are bringing cases where they're saying, hey, you fossil fuel company, you are emitting greenhouse gases that are then in turn causing sea level rise that is in turn damaging my coastal property and potentially killing people. This is the argument that's been made by the cities of San Francisco and Oakland, for example. And so the greenhouse gases are a nuisance to me, and you should stop that nuisance. And these are a very new kind of suit that have potentially massive economic ramifications, but may take some time to win.
do we have enough of those cases that have worked their way through the courts yet? I mean, in the case of the Giuliani case, they're presumably aiming for the Supreme Court, and that's still very much in process. But do we have enough of these cases that have worked their way through that we can say anything about their track record?
Well, what we can say is that to date, none of them have won. But I should say, you know, it's a small number of cases. And one thing that's important is that the science substantiating the claims of these litigants is moving very rapidly. And as that science progresses, these litigants may have a stronger leg to stand on. And so, you know, this work is advancing so quickly and there's so much changing that I hate to say, you know, they're definitely going to keep losing. So far they have, but I'm agnostic about what will happen next.
You know, you in your analysis make an interesting point, which is that with some climate litigation, winning is not necessarily critical to the goal of the case. What do you mean by that?
So no lawyer is going to bring a case to court that they don't think they have some grounds of winning on. Of course, they're not going to do that. Having said that, you know, some of these cases are real long shots. And I would say that's true for both the pro and the anti-regulatory sides. They're bringing the cases to win, sure, but they're also bringing the cases to make to frame this issue in the public eye in the way that they want it to be framed. I mean, this Giuliani case, for example, is a really novel way of understanding the transgenerational effects of climate change. I mean, this is not something the public has traditionally thought about, that my greenhouse gas emissions today are going to affect my children, my children's children, and, you know, change the future of this planet and therefore the very air that they breathe. And so this case is a very interesting way of reframing how we think about climate change. And this is not the only case in which that has been done. So, you know, even if you lose a case, bringing a case to the court gives a plaintiff an opportunity to say, hey, we need to be thinking more about this particular issue. We need to be drawing public attention to it. We need to take action on it. And often, you know, a case comes to the court when the other two branches of government haven't acted effectively or efficiently. And so it can be a way of saying, hey, you other two branches of government, step up and do something about this problem.
Sabrina McCormick of the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University and lead author of a new analysis of more than 25 years of climate litigation. She joined us via Skype. Sabrina, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Up next, what climate change is doing to New England's fisheries. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.